If you would like a free newsletter on this or other subjects, just give us a call at Christian Answers. The phone number is area code 512-218-8022. That's 512-218-8022. Or you could email us at cdebater@aol.com. That's cdebater@aol.com. Thank you.
Hello, this is Larry Wessels, Director of Christian Answers. I wanted to let our listeners know that we experienced technical difficulties with our master recording during this broadcast of the Ouija Board with Dr. Edmund Gruss. Unfortunately, the sound quality may be not quite up to normal standards at some points during the program, so please bear with us due to this problem. Thank you very much.
Welcome to Christian Answers Live, an outreach of Christian Answers, a nationwide apologetics ministry dedicated to contending for the faith that was once for all entrusted to the saints, dedicated to giving Christian answers. And now, from the studios of KIXL Radio in Austin, Texas, here are your hosts, Lee Meckley and Jim Tungate.
Good evening. I'm Lee Meckley, Director of Radio Outreach for Christian Answers, along with Jim Tungate. And Jim is our Director of Research and Editor of the Christian Answers Journal. And also tonight, we have with us Larry Wessels, who is our Director of Christian Answers. Gentlemen, how are you doing this evening?
We're doing fine, Lee.
Yes.
Okay. Now, tonight we're going to be dealing with a subject that I must confess, it's from at the beginning, I did not realize that you could actually do an entire show or write an entire book on this subject, but tonight we're going to be talking about Ouija boards. Now, this is going to be something that you definitely need to be listening to because they are quite popular nowadays, and according to our guest tonight, there are some things that you definitely need to know about these. Tonight we're going to be speaking to Edmund Gruss, who is Professor Emeritus at the Master's College in Santa Clarita, California. He is author of Cults and the Occult, also Apostles of Denial, an Examination and Exposé of the History, Doctrines, and Claims of the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Jehovah's Witnesses and Prophetic Speculation. Okay, yeah, we got you on the line now. Edmund, how are you doing this evening?
Fine.
Okay, I guess if you could comment briefly on what I had said at the beginning of the show. This is kind of interesting. I mean, I'd heard quite a bit about Ouija boards, but it didn't really occur to me that you could actually write a whole book on this subject.
Well, I didn't think a person could either until I started investigating the subject about 30 years ago. I started teaching a course in a Bible Institute dealing with various groups, including spiritualism, and often the subject of the Ouija board came up because he had been involved and the person who had been involved. And so I couldn't find much on it, and I started looking a little bit, and I found a little bit, and I found more, and I found more, and I had more people to talk to me. And ultimately, I thought, well, I should write maybe an article on it. And I did write an article that was published by Moody Press in a little Acorn booklet back in 1973. And then in 1975, I came out with a complete book because it related to the film The Exorcist, which was Ouija board related, not only in the film but also in real life. Then I was asked again to write something for Moody in 1986, and then that went out of print, and I had gotten a lot of material. I just thought, well, there's too much good stuff here, but good, I mean, important stuff here, and I think I'll get back to the desk and write a book that turned out to be over 200 pages long.
Edmund, who invented the Ouija board, and where did such devices originate originally?
Well, we have several things in that question. First of all, we have the Ouija board as a patented device, which was patented in 1891 by Elijah Bond. And that's the Ouija board, basically what we have today, with a few changes, but it's, you know, basic board with a little bit of changes given the number of years it went by. But devices like the Ouija board, go all the way back to ancient times, and we have devices that incorporate the alphabet and a pointer of some kind. It might be a pointer, or it might be that which is like a pendulum, or it might be some other like device that moves around and either describes an answer by spelling it out or points to various letters of the alphabet or numbers. And you can trace devices like that all the way through from ancient times, the Greeks, the Byzantines, devices in the Middle Ages, and then 19th century you have the practice of table tipping or knocking. And then you have a planchette, which comes into the picture. It's a way of automatic writing that comes into the picture mid-1850s, and ultimately we get to the combination of the device that moves with the alphabet and numbers and words that we have in the Ouija board, and that, as I said, was a patent device 1891.
Now, you mentioned a couple of things that maybe our audience may not be familiar with, and the first one was table knocking or table tipping.
Well, people would ask questions, and the table would either rap out internally. You'd hear a rapping sound. In other words, you could say, if you want to answer, one rap is A and two raps are B, that kind of thing. Or in some cases, the table would lift up and actually tap on one leg. That's the way I understand it, anyway. So that was the practice that was very current in the 19th century.
Right, and haven't they also used, like, wine glasses or crystal for the same purposes?
Well, when we talk about the Ouija board, we're talking about a patented device, but also in our country and abroad, England in particular, a person would just spell out the numbers of the alphabet, and put them on the table and a piece of glass, and then they'd use a wine glass or anything and throw it around the table, and they would ask questions. They have the same principle there, except it's not the patented device. It's doing the same thing.
We've talked a little bit about how the Ouija board works. If the Ouija board talks, where do the messages come from, Edmund?
Well, the first thing I would say is we're not saying that everything comes from the Ouija board is from some supernatural source. We set that aside. We just say in some cases we feel very strongly that it is. But if it's not by conscious movement of the pointer, and some people have done that just to fool somebody, you know, I really moved it. Many times neither of them actually move it to their knowledge, and yet it still seems to be spelling out something. But there are different interpretations. Some would say that's from the subconscious and imperceptible muscular movements are spelling out messages on the board. Some would say, yes, we do have the subconscious operating, but we also have a dimension that would be disincarnate spirits or other intelligences that are coming through. And most Christians would say, yes, there is a subconscious movement dimension, but in some cases you do have evil spirits or demons that are communicating through that device, because it is historically a divination device. It's an occult device. It's not the kind of game that it's made to be, although of course people can say it's a game, but historically it has not been associated with a game.
Is divination something that the Bible allows Christians to participate in?
No. Divination, occult involvement, is something that's universally condemned in Scripture, because it's clear that we aren't to be turning to these devices or the occult, but believers are to turn to God for their answers. And the occult is, or spiritualism or mediumship, any way you want to identify it, is clearly identified as wrong. It's viewed as apostasy, departing from God. And there are a number of references. I have some before me here, but there are a number of references that could be cited which would condemn occult involvement and occult devices.
Now, before we did this show, I guess it was about 2 months ago that I read your book when I received it from the publisher. After I read your book, I went at my office. I walked around and asked people, you know, have you ever used a Ouija board and what did you think? And one of the people in particular that stands out in my mind was a friend of mine who is a practicing witch, and I asked him, I said, well, what do you think about the Ouija board, and have you ever used it? And the look that came over his face kind of took me back a little bit. He said, no. He said, it is totally evil. He said, I wouldn't touch one of those, that there's, you know, many dangerous things that can happen, and it can be used to, for much evil. And he really didn't even want to talk about it after that. It kind of stuck out in my mind that maybe he'd had a bad experience with it himself. For those people out there who think that maybe this isn't such an important topic, according to Consumer Reports, the December 1994 issue, the only game that ranked above the Ouija board was Monopoly. And according to the statistics for girls, the second favorite game behind Twister was the Ouija board, and for boys, it was the fifth most popular game.
You're saying that is it was more popular than like Clue?
Oh, definitely.
Or Uno?
There's a whole list of different games. Yahtzee is, you know, way down at the bottom of the list. Othello, Pictionary, you know, games that we typically think of as being very popular. Well, the Ouija board ranks second, only behind Monopoly.
Well, let's ask Dr. Gruss. Doctor, what is this tremendous appeal where only Monopoly beats out the Ouija board?
Well, the age group there was ages 10 through 14. I think that tells you a little bit. And it included some 17,000 young people. I think at that age, they're looking for answers, and it's kind of exciting to get involved in it. And, you know, they can ask benign questions like, who will I go out with, or how will I do on my test, and that kind of thing. And what often happens, young people go to slumber parties, or even in some cases Christian camps. It happens, shouldn't it, does. And they're kind of isolated, and they're having a let's have a lot of fun time, and they get involved, and it's a little mysterious. And, anyway, I think it often gets started that way. People want to have answers, and they understand, here, I can ask Ouija or whatever they want to address the board as, and they get the answers that, well, so-and-so had an experience, and boy, it was exciting, and, you know, that kind of thing. I think it's why they get involved.
You know, in fact, I remember when I was about, I don't know, 11 or 12 years old, I was at my aunt's house. She was a couple of 3 years older than I was, and she had some of her teenage friends over, and they went into a dark room with this Ouija board, and they invited us to come in, and it was kind of fun, you know, for me as a little kid. We all went in this dark room, and everybody was kidding each other about spooks and stuff like this, and we put our hands on that Ouija board thing to get answers, you know, and I still remember I spooked some of them by actually moving it myself to fake them out, you know, and so there's a little bit of fun involved there too.
Well, I think at the same time that you've touched on something else that's that I think is important, and that's the aspect of fear. America and the world seems to be compelled by fear. They love to be scared. And it's just like when you're a little kid and you go in the bathroom with the lights off and look at the mirror to see if you see Bloody Mary. It's kind of the same thing with the Ouija board, where you're sitting there and you've heard that, you know, it's evil and it's kind of mysterious. And at the same time, you're trying to overcome a fear by participating in that.
Right. I'd just like for a moment to read a scripture here that's kind of an occult rundown from the scripture, just to mention it and then have Dr. Gruss elaborate on it just a little bit to get our biblical perspective down a little bit more here as we begin this program. In Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 9 through 14, we have an occult listing of all the different practices and so forth. And it says here, starting in verse 9, when thou art come into the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee, thou shalt not learn to do after the abominations of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone that maketh his son or his daughter to pass through the fire, or that uses divination, or an observer of times, or an enchanter, or a witch, or a charmer, or a consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard, or a necromancer. For all that do these things are an abomination unto the Lord. Because of these abominations, the Lord thy God doth drive them out from before thee. thou shalt be perfect with the Lord thy God. And then it says in verse 14, for these nations which thou shalt possess, hearken unto observers of times and unto diviners. But as for thee, the Lord thy God hath not suffered thee so to do. Now, Doctor, here we have some rather big King James words. For our listeners out there, could you maybe just kind of start at the top there and maybe explain what some of these abominations are, like a son or a daughter pass through the fire, and so forth as it goes, you know, observer of the times, enchanter, charmer, wizard.
I couldn't specifically divide each of those and explain each of those, because often it's a matter of different translations as to what the specific translation is, but you're dealing with all of these practices which are either turning to other gods or asking for wisdom from individuals who have contact with spirits, or people are reading the signs, whichever signs you're looking at, all kinds of signs, everything from the flow of water to flight of birds and wind. Those are actually conjuring up things, just like you'd have in practices of witchcraft. Those that are consulting the dead for answers. It'd be hard to take each of these and explain each, but you get the total picture here of apostasy, because when people turn to witchcraft or soothsayers or interpreters of omens or sorcerers, or those that conjure spells or mediums or whatever the other terms are there, they are in a state of apostasy.
Well, now, it's interesting here. You have an observer of times, which really is someone who interprets omens. You've got a wizard who is basically a spiritist. A charmer is someone who casts spells, things of this nature. Do you see the Ouija board as having a relationship to all these occultic practices? Can people... let's say, you know, you have necromancers and so forth that, you know, that speak with the dead and so forth. Can a Ouija board be interpreted in the sense, in an occultic sense of being in contact with spirits, let's say? Or can it be looked at as a way to interpret omens? In other words, is it a way to kind of combine all these different occultic practices into one simple little playful type form, which we find is a Ouija board?
It could, and in some cases it is used to introduce people, recruit people into these practices. As we mentioned in our book, individuals who have been involved in Satanism or in witchcraft, as another example, the board was used to recruit them into these other practices. So that could be the connection many times.
Very good.
Our guest tonight has a book out on the Ouija board, an entire book dedicated to talking about the Ouija board. It's published by Presbyterian Reformed. The name of the book is The Ouija Board, A Doorway to the Occult, again by our guest tonight, Edmund Gruss. And I was going to remark just before we went out for the break about one of the aspects of the Ouija board that you mentioned is that it is patented. So if I make a device like this, I can not only get in trouble with spirits, but I can also get in trouble with the government. Is that true?
There are all kinds of spin-offs from the board. It was of interest. A patent attorney investigated the matter of like devices for about 5 years, and he found about 100 different devices and maybe 100 different patents in addition. So many devices like this are called all different kinds of other names. But you can make it at home just so you don't use the word Ouija on it.
How did they come up with the name for the board and call it Ouija?
All depends. Many times you have some legend or lore that goes along with naming. William Fultz said that the board named itself, and Ouija means yes, yes in French and German. It seems that the word Ouija already was around before it was applied to the board that received the patent. But as I said, William Fold said the board named itself.
Now, you did say that William Fold is the inventor of the Ouija board, and that was...
Well, no, William Fold is the person who has received credit for it, but it really was patented by Elijah Bond. Although William Fuld was given the credit, and as he kind of checked into this to find out what was going on. It appears that William Fuld bought the rights to it from the Kennard company that had acquired it from Elijah Bond, and that's the way Fuld got a hold of it. And then Fuld got involved in inventing a new kind of a pointer and other stuff which related to the board. So the name associated with the board is William Fuld, but probably Elijah Bond was the one who actually invented that particular device.
Now, okay. Wasn't there a big controversy centering around the patentship of the board between Fuld and another individual?
His brother, because it became quite a financial windfall, it became a good seller and it was a moneymaker, and so we don't really know the relationship between two brothers relative to the board, but they went to court over it, and his brother Isaac wanted something in the way of either the patents or anyway made claims to it. And the family actually split over the matter of the board and who really was the one that should hold the patents and the like.
What eventually happened to Fuld?
Very interesting. According to his own account, this would be before probably about the time of World War One, maybe a little bit thereafter. I don't remember the exact date, but he told the reporter that he hadn't really consulted the board very often, but he did consult it on one matter, and that was concerning the future of the business. And according to his own account, the board told him to build a big business because of the future sales. And so he built the factory, according to his own account, that the board told him to build. And ironically, he went up on the top of this factory in 1927 to straighten out a flagpole on the roof and fell to his death from the very building the board indicated told him to build.
Very interesting.
So just to reiterate then, you're saying that Elijah Bond back around 1890, this is the year we're talking about?
1890, he applied for the patent and received the patent February the 10th of 1891.
I see, and then Fuld comes along later in that year and acquires it. And so we're talking about something that hasn't been around that long as we know it.
You figure 1891... and 95 now, a little over 100 years. But again, this specific patent device, we're not dealing with the practice or the approach. It's been around for thousands of years.
I see. And it sounds like just Fuld was the main marketeer. He picked it up from someone else, improved it, made it marketable, started mass producing it, and now we have it just all over the place. Who did you say puts this out now? What game company?
It was... bought by Parker Brothers.
Parker Brothers. That's I couldn't remember who it was.
What does 66. What does Parker Brothers have to say about the Ouija board?
What you'll find out, at least I tried a couple of times. One time, when I first was working on this subject about 20 years ago, I sent a letter asking if they had any statement on it. And they did send me a very interesting little brochure, which I'll give you a quote from in a moment. And then when I worked on this latest rendition of my book, I just got a letter with no brochure. And I was asking about sales, et cetera. And they told me about the number of boards sold with proprietary information. In other words, they wouldn't reveal it. But this brochure that I received about 20 years ago was entitled The Weird and Wonderful Ouija Talking Board Set. And I think it has a statement here that's very significant in connection with how the board should be viewed. Then their statement, I'm quoting now, "Frankly, Parker Brothers does not know. They are a leading manufacturer of games, but they doubt whether the Ouija talking board should really be regarded as a game. Interesting. They do know that many people have a lot of fun with it and that those who enjoy using it are often interested in the occult. I wonder if they'd like to continue distributing a brochure with this statement in it." Because a lot of people say, oh, there's nothing to it, just a game. And when they themselves are there, leading manufacturer of games, but they doubt whether the Ouija talking what you really got is the game.
Well, let me reiterate for a moment here on the operation and interpretation of the Ouija board. And as it says here on your in your book on page 30, it says there's some questions that are asked about this board. What makes it work? What is the source of the messages? Are the communications received through the board just a reflection of the operator's conscious or subconscious thought, or do they sometimes reveal contact with another dimension, the supernatural? If the latter is true, what is the evidence? We've kind of touched on this briefly in our opening segment. If we could kind of elaborate a little bit more now to some of these questions.
Okay, without a lot of specifics, just generally, often the content of the messages reveals information that the person receiving the message can't possibly know. It might give specific information concerning where a person is, might give information concerning historical events that a person that receives the message knows nothing about. And there is a remarkable account that goes back to the period 1913 and following, until her death in 1937. A woman by the name of Curran wrote novels that we are told were historically accurate through the Ouija board. So information that comes that the person doesn't have any source for internally or through their own experience. Another interesting thing concerning messages, the editor for my book was very eager to work on this book because she said she ran across a young lady in InterVarsity going back a number of years. And this young lady and her other friends were involved in using the board, and they were having fun with it, as is often expressed. And then they started asking questions that they couldn't possibly have the answer to, and they would check the answers in the encyclopedia or wherever the answer might be found, and found information was coming that was accurate that they couldn't possibly have in their own experience or own knowledge. So content of messages, that's one thing. Then many times the realization that this person has come under some external control, we can call either possession or obsession, and often there are cases of possession which relate to the Ouija board. Ed and Lorraine Warren, who are demonologists, experts in this field, probably have been out to check out 3,000 or 4,000 different cases. The last count that I received was that 7 out of 10 of their cases are related to Ouija board use, and many of these were possession cases. And then, in some cases, the board was subjected to tasks such as blindfolding of the individuals working at rearranging the letters, and in many cases, that work where the person couldn't possibly know it was being spelled out because they couldn't see the board, they didn't know where the letters were because they had been rearranged. And then what I call difficult to explain phenomena, such as physical manifestations. Often people say we're working it and there was a drop in temperature, so it became very cool in the room. A wind blew through the room to the point where even small things were blown off the shelf or off the wall. William Peter Blatty, who wrote the Exorcist book and also worked in the film, said that he was working the board himself, and he had some mechanical birds that sang when the mechanics of these birds were broken. I had a woman who wrote to me who said that she used to construct boards with the use of the glass and all, and she had a skeptic in her seance. That's what she was conducting. And he said, "Oh, you're just your hands." So she pulled her hands off, and to the amazement of everybody there, that wine glass kept them going along, moving along in a circle, and she was frightened by what she saw too. So we can just say physical manifestations, drop of temperature, wind, singing of birds in this case, or whatever else is operated that shouldn't be operated, movement without hands, in some cases a foreign language has come through. Those are all things that, you know, you can explain some things, but, you know, I've got something here that seems to be another dimension that's operative that you can't explain.
Okay. I was going to ask you a couple of questions. First of all, the book is available, I guess, in Christian bookstores? Do they have to dial an 800 number to get a hold of a copy?
Christian bookstores all over our country here, and also probably in England and Australia, other places have it. It's also distributed by Baker Bookhouse. No, I shouldn't say that. I have the wrong, the other book is. But it's distributed through Christian bookstores all over the country.
Okay. Now, you mentioned something before we left for the break about the producer or the writer for the movie The Exorcist. And your book actually talks about the Ouija board's role in the book and or the movie. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Okay. Some of the people listening might remember that the novel The Exorcist came out in 1971, and the film that really shook things up came out in 1973. And at the time, I was interested in the subject of the Ouija board, and someone said, hey, there's a Ouija board connection there, so I went to see the film, and then I wrote to William Peter Blatty, and I got other information. And the Exorcist plot story goes back to an experience of a 14-year-old boy in Mount Rainier, Maryland, back in August of 1949. It made the newspaper or papers at that time. And Blatty saw that, and as a student and a person interested in this kind of thing, he pursued it, and it ultimately became the novel and the film. So in the novel and film, instead of a 14-year-old boy, you have a girl, and a good deal of the account, though, in the book and film recreate what did take place, not slavishly, but at least the general outline of things that took place are there. It's also interesting that in the summer of 1993, an entire book came out dealing with the same case. And the book is titled Possessed, The True Story of an Exorcism, and was written by Thomas B. Allen, published by Doubleday. It's dealing with the same exorcist case upon which the novel and the film were based, the actual case behind it.
Now, I remember when I was just a high school kid, I remember back then I used to watch the Johnny Carson show, the Tonight Show, and I remember Blatty was on the show as a guest, and I remember Johnny Carson asking him about how he came up with this book, and he said things similar to what you're saying. He said he actually based the stuff on some actual, you know, possession cases and things. And we have this situation of exorcism mentioned here. And just for the sake of our listeners, in the movie The Exorcist, you find that the Catholic priests that are in this movie, I think they both end up getting killed at the end of the movie, and you know, sort of like score two for the devil, and the demon, you know, kind of gets away with things. I think they came up with an Exorcist 2 and 3 and whatever else they came up with. But in an actual exorcism, just for listeners to clarify things, if you're dealing with a truly demon-possessed person, is a true Christian in danger of being killed by demons, or are they protected by the blood of Christ?
I would say there is danger. I don't think danger of being killed, but there is an attempt often by a demon to intimidate individuals. I don't think it should be taken lightly, but I would say that a Christian is standing on solid ground as a Christian and biblically strong, can't deal with such a thing, but not to take it lightly.
Okay, so a true born-again, washed in the blood child of God who understands what he's dealing with is not in any danger of being killed by the demons.
I wouldn't think so, but stranger things have happened. But I'm just saying that take it seriously. And
exactly. If you're, let's say, a weak Christian, someone that's not prepared for this kind of spiritual warfare, the last place you really want to be is dealing with some demon-possessed person and the entities that are abounding with them. I guess what I'm just basically trying to say is, if you're truly in Christ, you know, through the power of His name and by His blood, you should be safe from demonic attack.
I haven't dealt with cases of possession. I've dealt with cases where there seem to be demonic working in an individual, but some of my students on the mission field have dealt with caves of possession. But it's very important to pray and to have command of the Word of God and to challenge whatever is coming to that individual. But there will be attempts to intimidate, such as, we can get you, we can do this to you. And then the response to them, of course, for the Christian is, you could do it, but I'm not alone. I'm standing in the strength of God.
Amen.
Right.
I was just in Atlanta last week, and at the hotel, I was in the dining room, and a little old lady walked up to me, and we began a conversation. It turned out that her and her husband were former missionaries down in Trinidad, and this evangelist had come into town. They set up a big tent meeting, and it ended up that this person showed up at the meeting. He had been brought there by others, and he was possessed. And this evangelist was just beside himself. He had no idea what to do and ended up actually running out of the tent and fleeing for his life. He had no idea what was going on or how to even approach a situation.
That's often what happens. I would say in some cases, pastors aren't prepared for dealing with something like that. And are the last ones that would want to do something was needed. As I said, it's not to be taken lightly. It's a serious business, and the fright involved in dealing with something like that, especially if you've never seen it, is really something. The voice or voices and the threats and all that. You need people around you to pray and to sustain you, and sometimes there's a matter of commanding the spirit of demon to just shut up.
This reminds me of the book of Acts, Acts chapter 19, verses 13 through 16, which says, "Then certain of the vagabond Jews, exorcists, took upon them to call over them which had evil spirits the name of the Lord Jesus, saying, We adjure you by Jesus whom Paul preacheth." In verse 14, "And there were seven sons of one Siva, a Jew and chief of the priests, which did so. And the evil spirit answered and said, Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who are ye?" Verse 16, "And the man in whom the evil spirit was leaped on them and overcame them and prevailed against them, so that they fled out of the house naked and wounded." So I guess this is a good example of what can happen in just one case of people trying to deal when they're ill prepared, especially since they're not saved in this case, with demon-possessed people.
I also look at that reference as an excellent example of why we say demons are real personalities.
Mm-hmm.
They're not just thought or whatever, because there you have them thinking, speaking, acting, and that's what would be involved in being a person or a personality.
Right, and you also, and this was something else that was brought out in the movie The Exorcist, was the feats of great strength, and the man in the Bible who lived in the tombs was in chains, and apparently was quite violent. This, to me, gives me a perception that anytime you're dealing with a situation like this, there is the possibility of physical harm coming to a Christian. But at the same time, Scripture also says, fear not the one who can destroy the body, but fear the one who can cast your soul into hell, which is God.
Well, that ties in with what you're just saying, a reference in Luke chapter 8, verses 26 through 37, and you see there where Jesus casts out this legion of demons, where they asked Jesus to let them go into all these swine.
Right.
And you see what happens to the swine. They're all destroyed in the sea. So there's a lot of destructive power associated with the spirits and demons, especially in possession cases, where they apparently in this case can even possess animals.
One of the most stirring accounts that you give in your book, Edmund, is of a young girl who begins to play with the Ouija board and actually becomes infatuated with the spirit that's communicating with her in the board. Why don't you relate that story to us?
Oh, I can relate some of it. Yeah, I believe you're talking about the Patty Donovan.
Right.
This case and some others I picked up are from the book The Demonologist by Gerald Brittle. I talked with him over the phone. And he's picking up these cases from what the Warrens were involved in. But here was a girl who was involved with the Ouija board, and she probably was involved for a long period of time, maybe for about a year or so. And the Ouija character that came through became her boyfriend in her own thinking. And she finally got the place, and this is often what takes place as these contacts continue over a period of time. The girl then asked for a physical manifestation. And she didn't make the connection with what was happening just after that request. But the house, in one word, is vandalized.
The tires on the cars were cut, and then they had them repaired, and then put it in the garage, and then the tires were slashed again, and the car was vandalized, and
rocks pelted the house, and furniture levitated, and the house was, one word, trashed. It looked like someone had taken all the stuff out of the cabinets and dumped the stuff that would be liquid and salt and pepper and all that stuff in on the floor and mixed it all up, and that happened, I believe, a couple of times. Wallpaper was torn off the walls, and messages were on the walls, and pounding, just like the house going to be shaken down, burning of pictures, and it just, I called it a nightmare. I didn't want to even finish it because it got worse and worse, and all I could say, it was like a nightmare. Even when I left the house, this kind of thing followed them to the motel where they stayed.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talked to Gerald Brittle, and also I brought a little statement in my book, he indicated that the cases that were included in this book, the demonologists, were not cases that were ill documented, the cases that were observed and put on tape and in other ways observed by people.
Well, right, even when the house was being pelted by rocks, there were police officers present, people in the neighborhood. So there were numerous witnesses to these events.
And I brought these cases, this being one of them, into the book because often people think, well, The Exorcist is just something that's kind of an unusual thing that never happens. And I thought, well, while The Exorcist is an older case, there are other things going on that have some of the same kind of things happening, in some cases even worse. And so I brought those other examples in, so that people could see that this kind of thing is not unique. One case was from Enfield, England, so things can happen other than in the United States. And a couple of these cases in the United States, Cindy McBain, a 15-year-old, and her experiences. This was from another book of the Ghost Hunters. And again, it's a very serious thing. It's not something that can be just sloughed off and there's nothing to it. And so the problem is many times people who know nothing about the subject are so knowledgeable, in quotes. They say, well, you know, there's nothing to it, but they haven't investigated it. And so there are a lot of experts who don't have any real information to decide that it's all just nonsense or a game or to be taken lightly.
Sounds like you're talking about ignorant know-it-alls.
Yeah.
Well, we're almost out of time here. I would like to, for the second hour, I'd like to really get into a lot more of these case studies and histories that you've provided in your book to give people a little sampling of it. I would like to mention here from your book on page 102, you list something called Symptoms of Occult Activity Involvement compiled from actual case studies and interviews as of September 1989 from Emin. And it mentions a lot of symptoms of extensive Ouija board use, such as frightening, recurring nightmares, voices, insomnia, apparitions, suicidal and murderous thoughts, extremely secretive demeanor, time loss, memory gap, violent behavior, poltergeist activity, depression, withdrawal from society, drug use, physical contact by a seen or unseen entity, sometimes sexual, involuntary muscle spasm not associated with drug use, also described as a shaking or vibrating bed, or the sensation of mild earthquakes, or almost, there's many more I could list here, but that ought to give people a sample.
After the break.
Good evening. I'm Lee Meckley, Director of Radio Outreach for Christian Answers, along with Jim Tungate, who is our Director of Research and Editor of the Christian Answers Journal. And also tonight with us in the studio, we have Larry Wessels, who is the Director of Christian Answers. And we are talking with Edmund Gruss. He is the author of a book called The Ouija Board, A Doorway to the Occult, published by Presbyterian and Reformed. Reading a little bit from the book release here. Innocent fun or introduction to the occult, billed as a harmless game, the Ouija board has drawn countless users, especially young people, into a web of deception and demonic activity. The results can be tragic. Obsession, possession, insanity, suicide, and murder. Without sensationalism, Edwin Gruss demonstrates through one startling case after another that these dangers are all too real. He traces the occult ancestry of the Ouija board and explores possible sources of messages, as well as Ouija's role in The Exorcist, which we were talking about last hour, and the modern channeling movement. Gruss combines compelling documentation with a solid biblical response and offers practical steps for those struggling with the occult. Edmund Gruss is Professor Emeritus at the Master's College in Santa Clarita, California. He's author of Cults and the Occult, also Apostles of Denial, an examination and expose of the history, doctrines, and claims of the Jehovah's Witnesses, and the Jehovah's Witnesses and Prophetic Speculation, as well as several other books on the cults and the occult. Again, the book we're talking about tonight, The Ouija Board, A Doorway to the Occult, published by Presbyterian and Reformed. Edmund, are you still with us?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you again very much for being on the program tonight.
Could I pick up that Eamon quote you were using?
Sure, please do.
I'd like to put it in a little bit of a context. Randy Eamon, at the time, was a sergeant in the police department and also was an expert on the occult. And he would go out and he would speak to teenage groups. Many of these groups would be in Christian schools. And after his presentations, he often would have young people come and talk with him. And he interviewed about 1,500 teenagers between the years you mentioned, 1985 through 92. Who had been involved in the occult, and what you were quoting was what he came up with as a result of these interviews. And while all of these things you're reading and more in addition related to the occult, many of them, almost all of them, could also and were related to Ouija board use. So this was the occult generally, but as I looked down them, I said, hey, we find the same things in Ouija board use as manifestations of extensive use.
And just to reiterate, you're talking about the symptoms of like insomnia, frightening reoccurring nightmares, violent behavior, poltergeist activity, depression, drug use, physical contact by a seen or unseen entity, sometimes sexual, and so forth, involuntary muscle spasm, that quotation right before the break.
And the interesting thing is, as he looked at these statistics, because he was interested, why do young people get involved with this occult realm, and how do they get involved? And he said better than two-thirds that he interviewed said the main item of curiosity that caused them to continue deeper interest in the occult was their experimentation with the Ouija board. So it was like the open door. That's why we titled our book, the Ouija board, A Doorway to the Occult. I purposely put A in there because this is only one of the possibilities. And that's what he found, too.
Now, Lee had mentioned a little bit earlier one of the aspects is channeling, and that has become very prominent today. There's been many books that have been written through channeling, and, you know, J.Z. Knight comes to mind whenever the word channeling comes up.
Ramtha.
And one of the things that I found very astounding that was in your book was when you related the case about the gentleman who started AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and the role that a Ouija board played in that.
Do you want me to mention a little bit about that?
Yes, sir.
Okay. As I was getting this subject, you know, many times people think this whole thing just relates to children or people that aren't too well-known or just, you know, no one that you'd be concerned about. But as I was investigating this, I came across the material actually published by Alcoholics Anonymous. And in their own material, they talk about Dr. Bob Smith and Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, and Pass It On. These are the title of the books. And I was amazed to find the place that spiritualism generally and the Ouija board specifically played in the early years of Alcoholics Anonymous. And do you have my book handy there?
Yeah, sure do.
Turn to page 66. And,
okay.
You might just read that to the folks out there. You have the background of Ouija board use, and they have a room in the home that's called a spook room. And then you have his own description of what took place on page 66.
Starting at the top of the page, yes. Says as early as 1941, Bill and Lois were holding regular Saturday spook sessions at Bedford Hills. One of the downstairs bedrooms was dubbed by them the spook room. Here they conducted many of their psychic experiments. Bill Wilson provides an account of one of his Ouija board sessions. The Ouija board got moving in earnest. What followed was the fairly usual experience. It was a strain, melange of Aristotle, St. Francis, diverse archangels with odd names, deceased friends, some in purgatory and others doing nicely, thank you. There were malign and mischievous ones of all descriptions, telling of vices quite beyond my ken, even as former alcoholics. Then the seemingly virtuous entities would elbow them out with meaningless messages of comfort, information, advice, and sometimes just sheer nonsense. Says that Bill also received messages without the board. His wife describes one of these sessions. Bill would lie down on the couch, and he would get these things. He kept doing it every week or so, each time certain people would, quote, come in, end quote. Sometimes it would be new ones, or they would carry on some story. There would be long sentences, word by word, would come through. This time, instead of word by word, it was letter by letter, and Anne, who was a neighbor, put them down letter by letter. The communication in this case was in Latin, a language that Bill understood only slightly. Bill took the material to a classical scholar, who read the messages and was impressed by it. Bill Wilson wrote the now famous, quote, 12 steps. Says, while laying in bed, with a pencil in hand and a pad of yellow scratch paper on his knee, he started to write. He asked for guidance, and he relaxed. The words began tumbling out with astonishing speed. He completed the first draft in about half an hour, then kept on writing until he felt he should stop and review what he had written. Numbering the new steps, he found that they all added up to 12, a symbolic number. He thought of the 12 apostles and soon became convinced that a society should have 12 steps.
It's interesting, the last paragraph treating this subject, Tom was a regular at the seances and maintained that Bill and Dr. Bob believed vigorously and aggressively that working away at spiritualism, it was not just a hobby. It related to AA because the big problem in AA is that for the materialist, it's hard to buy the program. In other words, they were trying to bring in some spiritual dimension, and this is the way they were doing it.
In Alcoholics Anonymous, and we've got the famous 12 steps. It sounds like he used automatic writing to come up with the whole thing.
Quote says, I'm not saying it was, but it sure made a person sympathetic to channeling speculate. By this description, could it be that Bill went into his meditative state and used automatic writing to channel the 12 steps? It sounds so much like automatic writing at that point.
It's very interesting.
Now this 12 steps, isn't that used by a lot of psychology groups and doctors?
Groups and New Age groups and whatever they put in content, you have 12 steps all over the place now.
Huh. And it just comes right. This all reminds me of one of the best-selling Christian books to ever to come down. You find it on a bestseller list in many Christian bookstores throughout the decade, I guess. It's called God Calling.
I've written on that.
Yes. This book is a bestseller. I've had it removed from several Christian bookstores now, but they usually have it on their shelf wherever you go. And it's interesting that here's a book, God Calling, and it was translated entirely by automatic writing and communication with the spirits. And, of course, as you look at it, you find that the words for God are very vague and nebulous.
Right.
You can kind of... Excuse me?
like divine mind in some cases.
Right. Which it's exactly the same with the whole aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous. They believe in a belief in a power higher than themselves, but that higher power is never defined.
Yeah, so you define it for your own sake, your own belief.
Well, is there any more channeling that can be tied in with this Ouija board situation?
Well, going back to the beginning of the chapter this would be chapter 9, Jane Roberts, her married name was Butts, back in 1963, thought that she'd write a book on do-it-yourself ESP using the Ouija board as a way of getting into that area. And she said, well, before I write a book, I guess I better get a board. But she did, and then beginning in the December of 1963, messages started coming through, and then the character, which became the subject of a book, Seth, appeared. And her book, How to Develop Your SP Power, was published in 1966. But when Seth appeared, he became a dominating character for her other books, and she wrote books like Seth Speaks and other Seth books, and they became the example of how to get into this area, and others followed her, and you have a person by name Sinea Roman, and she started with the Ouija board too, and Dr. Catherine Rydell also looked at the Seth material and got involved in channeling through the Ouija board. Anyway, it seems like Jane Roberts started the channeling movement using the Ouija board as one approach to it, one way to get into it. And she's credited by the sources that are non-Christian sources, books dealing with the New Age movement, like, as being the one who started the channeling movement.
Right.
Tying in with the Seth, and well, you also have a mention here of Michael. Who's this Michael?
Chelsea Yarbrough compiled a number of these messages received over a number of years, and this is another group of individuals that got together, and they channeled through the Ouija board, or they made their own board because they were using it so much, and it was so much wear and tear on their own board, they made their own board to stand up under the messages. But she wrote, actually she compiled messages from Michael, which came out in 1979, and then more messages from Michael, which came out in 1986, and Michael's people in 1988. And then others started claiming that they were channeling Michael, and as others also claimed to be channeling Seth. So you get started in this area, and it influences others, and it just goes well beyond the initial ones who are using the board or having experiences.
You know, these messages permeate the internet. They have Usenet groups dedicated to channeling, and in there you can find messages from every quarter, including I believe it's Commander Core, who channels an alien. Then you have over in London the Theria Society, headed up by Dr. King, who says that there's a group of aliens headed up by an alien named Atherius, and they're at war with a group of black magicians here on Earth, and they want King to encourage his fellow humans to allow these aliens to channel through them so they can defeat the black magicians. And you find all kinds of strange things, including, I believe it's Jack Scallion out in California, who uses channeling to prophesy about cataclysmic events that are taking place. But generally, overall, what is the message that is coming through these entities that are being channeled? Well, what are they saying about Jesus? What are they saying about, you know, the state of humanity and the direction that humanity is supposed to go?
I think you can generalize and also be specific. Every channel message that I've read that's been in print or whatever form it was in is a basic denial of everything that a Christian would hold, and that's universally what you find. John Weldon found the same thing. Every single channel message that he looked at, and others I've talked to too, it's a basic denial of Christianity, And often it's the message that you are God, and there's a new age coming, and it's just a really new age movement type of thing that is coming through. And I tell students, the one thing that's clear, it's 100% denial of biblical Christianity.
Now, this would include as well messages that are supposedly channeled by Jesus himself.
Oh, in some cases, Jesus, in quotes, is communicating, and his message is not the Jesus of Scripture.
You're listening to Christian Answers Live. I'm Lee Meckley, and all of this discussion tonight is coming off of our general topic of the Ouija board, the things that can result from the use of the Ouija board, and so forth and so on.
One of the things I've been itching to talk about is something that Larry mentioned earlier in the list that he read off of symptoms that are sometimes related to Ouija board use, and one of those was poltergeist activity. Now, Edmund, is there such things as ghosts? I mean, I don't seem to find anything in Scripture that would support the idea of ghosts, humans who have deceased and who continue to lauder here on earth to take care of unfinished business. What is the biblical perspective that we should take on that issue?
Well, the biblical perspective is that when people die, their spirit is not left behind to wander about, but you have either going to heaven or to hell. What we call poltergeist activity, that's the usual term for it, would be demonic activity. That would be our interpretation of what is taking place.
Right.
In that scripture, you have, of course, the dead are not behind to wander about to do certain things, like so many would say.
Well, I was just looking here on page 123 of your book. You have court cases and newspaper reports. You have a subheading here called A Haunting Case, involving the L.A. Times and the experiences of Jackie Hernandez and her two-year-old son. Could you, just for the listeners out there, could you elaborate a little bit on this story? And we'll just kind of get into some of these cases and mention some more about poltergeists and ghosts and things of that nature as we go.
Well, this was an article I came up with more recently because I collected a number of the other stories that go back to the 30s or 40s or 20s or whenever the specific time was. And I was reading the LA Times that mentioned this haunting case which took place down San Pedro. And to make a long story short, Jackie Hernandez and her two-year-old son were subjects of visitations that would be called generally hauntings, and this kind of thing did continue as they moved up to Kern County. And I'm just looking at the section here.
Yeah, I'm reading here, like it says, quote, "The ordeal," Hernandez says, "was a grade A waking nightmare replete with strange lights, colored mists, apparitions, and stinking blood-like liquid oozing from the walls," end quote. You know, and she just goes on to, I mean, you know, she'd say, quote, "The phenomenon began slowly. The cat chased eerie shadows around the house. Voices muttered in the attic. She saw pencils fly out of a pencil holder. She thought she was hallucinating, perhaps because of her pregnancy," end quote. And, you know, it just, this reads like a good Vincent Price horror flick, you know.
The reason this interested me, I tried to get more information on it, but didn't get any response, but it interested me because the Ouija board was mentioned in connection with this, because they used the Ouija board to try to find out what was happening. And as I said here, the Ouija board was mentioned twice in the article. They're trying to establish why this was taking place, and so they turned to the old device, the Ouija board, two times. And they even mentioned this development up in Kern County, as I recall. For starters, researchers could not get their video cameras to work. Something kept switching off the equipment. Part in desperation, she suggested the investigators try the Ouija board. As it began, she recalls the table began to shake, and the session ended when photographer Wheatcraft was thrown against the trailer wall by an invisible force. And so it relates to what might be termed normally haunting experience, and then trying to check it out, and then this kind of thing continuing at the second location. And again, the interest here was that they actually consulted the Ouija board to find out what was happening, and they got this further manifestation at that point.
Well, it certainly seemed, and this is right in the Los Angeles Times newspaper.
That's why I took it, because they wouldn't normally publish an article that didn't have some basis for it.
Mm-hmm. After all, this wasn't a National Enquirer that we were reading here. And you've got other case history. Would you like to mention a couple of them?
Well, the most interesting was this one that relates to the six AWOL intelligence specialists from Augsburg, Germany. They were in the military, six of them, five fellows and one girl. And I saw a little article in a paper on it, and so I contacted the person who had given a statement to the press. Vance Davis is his name, and Vance Davis said that he and these others were investigating the occult realm, and they started with the Ouija board, and they started getting all these messages. They worked the board for hours on end, not just 1 hour, but maybe 5-10 hours at a time, and they were given all kinds of information and instructions and predictions, and they were told that they should return to the United States to help in the work that was necessary. So they actually deserted their post, and they eventually were found and arrested in the area of Gulfstream, Florida, which has had UFO sightings. But they definitely, or Vance said, they definitely were not involved in UFO stuff. But he said that it was amazing what was happening to the board. The speed of the messages, the answers were given, the predictions that were set forth. As you would understand, they were so impressed by what was happening, they had deserted their posts and actually were arrested and discharged from the military on the basis of what they'd done as a result of following Ouija's instructions. So it must have been very powerful to them, what was coming through.
Do you see any connection here between messages coming from the Ouija board and, let's say, these so-called contacts with alien beings from UFOs?
I didn't bring it into my book, but there are look for a UFO, and the two are connected, where they're told to look for the UFO, and there was a UFO connection. There are those who are in UFO cults, we can call them, who use the Ouija board to make contact, and that's the way they do make contact with what they think are UFOs.
You know what? That's fascinating. All this is kind of fascinating. Always get into that mysterious, eerie stuff.
Right.
That's why they call it the occult, because it's the secret and hidden things, you know, from the Latin. But anyway, this reminds me of when I was, it must have been 13, 14 years ago. I used to work in a Tom Thumb grocery in a bakery, and I worked with, you know, a lot of secular people and things like this, not non-Christians. And I'll never forget this one guy who was just kind of an average Joe. He didn't believe in anything, basically. But I mentioned the Ouija board to him one time, and boy, he got like of a ghost-like look on his face. And he said his brother had a Ouija board, and he told me this story, but he went way out of his way to say, "You better... You'll never believe me," and all this kind of stuff. And but I finally was able to get it out of him because I was so curious, you know, over time. And it's funny how here you can have a secular person, and they have a little story that's kind of like a supernatural type of story when they really don't believe in the supernatural. They're kind of like atheists. But he did say he believed in ghosts after this experience with the Ouija board. He said he went over there to his brothers, and he was just spending the night with them, and all of a sudden they were just sitting around, I think he said, in one room listening to the radio, and the radio went off by itself. And his brother just started saying, "It's that stupid ghost again with that Ouija board," you know. And right at that moment, his brother seemed to be hit with an invisible force, this guy was telling me, which knocked the wind out of him. And, you know, he didn't say so much after that. But the whole experience, and he had a few other things he said, I don't remember now, it was so many years ago. But it was interesting that here was a secular man that, you know, I knew him for years, and he would have a story like this related to the Ouija board. It's just that he had this little story that he said no one would believe him on.
Now, Edmund, didn't the British Psychical Society denounce Ouija boards?
Yes. The interesting thing is often you get leading denouncers before me a little treatment from the Psychic News. It was published September 21st, 1968, and they bring up the British Psychical Society. But a front page article in the Psychic News, a noted spiritualist newspaper, and they're warning, unless urgent action is taken, thousands of children will find a potentially dangerous psychic game in their Christmas stockings this year. It goes on and mentions Ouija boards. They say it can be mentally hazardous, mentions mental disturbances, could seriously disturb the mind and possibly plant fears and phobias in the unconscious. And then it mentions the Society for Psychical Research, a member, Simon Edwards, Edmonds, expressing a personal opinion, told me that his report last week, any responsible person, whatever his views on the origin of the Ouija board messages, would be in agreement that this is not a game for children. And that's probably the reference you were thinking about.
Mm-hmm. Have there been documented cases where it has caused people to become mentally unstable, leading perhaps to insanity, to suicide, or to kill?
Yes, I have some of those included in my book, but I'll tell you what I found. I was working on a book dealing with groups in general, and I went back to Virginia Beach, Virginia, and I went to the Edgar Casey Foundation. I'm not endorsing Edgar Casey's Association of Research Enlightenment. That's another cult I have in my book. But another book. But I was able to read letters there from people who had been involved in Ouija board use, and some of them were written from mental institutions. And they told how they got involved with the board, and they were saying people should be warned not to get involved in this, but they were actually written from either mental institutions or people who had been returned after they finished their stay there, and it was Ouija board related. That's why I wanted to go back and read the letters. Like, they wouldn't send them to me. I had to read them there, so the letters were brought out, and I was able to read them there in our library.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a number of cases that related to mental illness, and as my book brings out, there are some cases of suicide. I mentioned the case of some girls in Zurich, Switzerland, back in 1990, who were told by the board that they were going to live only until the age of 18, or they would die before the age of 18, and so they, being 13 to 14, others were involved, but only two jumped, and they jumped their deaths off a building 200 feet down, and they died. And there are other cases like that, where people take what comes through seriously, and as a result of that, it gives them reason to make a decision, which can be very, in this case, fatal.
Now, this Ouija board is as we've already mentioned before, it's very popular. It's only second to Monopoly. With Christmas time coming on, what kind of numbers are we talking about here? Parker Brothers produces this thing. Is it sold? I guess we're talking in the millions. Do you have any idea what the statistics are in sales for the Ouija board on a yearly basis from Parker Brothers, or what the sales are around Christmas time, or do you have any information like that?
As I indicated, I asked them the question, and they didn't give an answer, but I have some figures I can quote. When Parker Brothers took it over, it, for the first and only time, beat Monopoly, 2.3 million to 2.1 million sales. From other figures, sales were 400,000, 700,000. The customer relations person mentioned figures at least sometime during the past, since 67, of 2 million. But they didn't give any definite figures beyond these things I've mentioned and the other source I've looked into. So we're talking about high hundreds of thousands, possibly. At least there are some years where they've been up to 2 million boards. But when you figure that, and figure out how many people can get involved as a result of those, plus the ones that have been sold every year, you've got, you know, a lot of potential out there for getting involved.
And they're only $15, and any little child can walk into a toy store or to a five and dime store and purchase one of these.
And, you know, sometimes parents will buy them and have no idea what is happening or what will happen. In some cases, I've had letters from people where a deacon or an elder gave a board to another family in the church as a Christmas present or some other another occasion.
You know, this reminds me so much of the scripture, and of course after our next break we'll get into this in more detail, but in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 verses 13 through 15 it says, "For such are false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ, and no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore it is no great thing that his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness, whose end shall be according to their works." Now this reminds me of, here you've got something packaged like a children's toy, and it's a deadly trap. It's the devil's tool himself, it almost looks like, to entrap people. But it's packaged so nicely. Parker Brothers, you know. And just like these ministers of righteousness are really the angels, you know, false apostles and deceitful workers here in this other context in 2 Corinthians chapter 11.
Now, I wanted to make the point that the Ouija board in and of itself, I don't believe, is dangerous. But it's what you do with the Ouija board. Any time that you open yourself up to contact with spiritual entities, something may just happen. And I wanted you to comment on that, Edmund.
Yes, this is what you said, a little paraphrase of a quote I have right before me. Ed Lorraine Warren said the very same thing here, that Ouija is nothing by itself. It's just a pressed piece of board with the alphabet on it. Same effect can be had with an upside-down wine glass and a wax table, but in either case, it's a medium for communication. In other words, it's what you use the object for. You use the Ouija board, you give permission for an unknown spirit to communicate with you. Would you open up the front door to your house and let in anyone who felt like it? Of course not.
Right.
Yet that's exactly what you're doing on a supernatural level. You said many times, doors have got to be opened before most of this activity can occur. The Ouija board is one way to do it. And that, you know, people say, oh, the board just pressed the masonite, this and that. That's right. But it's also a way of communicating, and the board doesn't have any magic in it. It's how you then get involved in it and use it as a means of communication.
Now, there are some things that float around that, I mean, obviously are false about the Ouija board that are legendary in proportion, like the one that I'm the most familiar with that I've heard so often is that each Ouija board contains a demon, and that if you throw the board in the fire, the demon will scream and hiss and evaporate. That's just some of the wild stories, but you know, we're not trying to come from this from a sensationalistic perspective. We just want people to be forewarned that this is not just a simple game, but that in fact that it is dangerous.
I would like to quote two sources here because they're non-Christian sources. One is notoriously non-Christian, Manly P. Hall. He was the founder of the Philosophical Research Society, and he would really be completely removed from anything Christian in his position. And I ran across an article he wrote in his publication, Horizon, back in 1944. And I mentioned 44 because it says during the last 25 years, he mentions having a lot of personal contacts with people who had dabbled with the board. Out of every 100 such cases, now these are cases that are referred to him, at least 95 are worse off for the experience. Some have suffered years of personal unhappiness as a penalty for the disorganization which this little table has brought in their lives. I know of broken homes, estranged families, and even suicides that can be traced directly to the source. In some cases, health has suffered seriously. In others, the psychic dabbling has led to serious financial losses. The remaining 5 out of every 100 actually secured information which was valuable or important to them. Even in these cases, however, the Ouija board is not solutional in any general way. And the interesting thing is these people receiving all these messages from, he says, Jesus and Buddha and Plato and various angels and archangels, such communication, of course, overwhelms the recipient, works havoc with his ego because he thinks, well, look, you know, I'm connected with. And so he says here, I have examined a great number of these awful revelations, and while they may bear the authentic signature of some great person, the content always belies the signature. Yet perfectly honest persons, when convinced that they have been ordained by the spirit world to work in their time great earth solutions, develop evangelical zeal, and the result is disastrous in every sense of the word. Now here's a person who's not within the Christian camp at all, but he says this is dangerous, and all the things he mentioned, suicide and broken homes, etc., etc. And a reason I put quotes like this in, because many times people say, oh, that's just you Christians, that's, you know, you're just off the wall with this stuff. But so many of the quotes I was able to gather were completely removed from the Christian camp. They would be anti-Christian.
Right. I would like to, as we get near the conclusion of our show, I'd like to center in on your final chapter here in your book, The Biblical View of Demons, Demonic Activity, and Possession. And I really love this list here you have. I don't like what they do, but I like the way you have it listed out here with the scripture verses on page 175 of demonic activities. I'd just like to take a moment here to read some of this and then start to have you talk more about this this demonic perspective here as it relates to the Ouija board. Anyway, you have listed here about demonic activities. One, they sometimes promote idolatry. You have Acts 16:16 and other verses. Two, since Satan is not omnipresent, they are necessary to him to extend his power. Ephesians 6:11-12. They can cause mental disorders. Luke 9:39. They can inflict physical ailments, Matthew 9:32-33. They are sometimes responsible for the dissemination of false doctrine, 1 Timothy chapter 4, verse 1. They may be used of God to carry out his purposes, 1 Kings 22:22. They sometimes seduce humans into immoral activities, 1 Timothy chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. They have power to work miracles and signs to deceive men, Revelation chapter 16, verses 14. They sometimes attempt to instigate jealousy, faction, and pride among believers, James chapter 3, verses 13 through 16. They may impart superhuman strength, Mark chapter 5, verse 4. They sometimes act as fortune tellers and prophets. The damsel who was possessed by a spirit of Python furnishes a New Testament example of this, Acts 16:16. Many of the familiar spirits of the Old Testament may have been such demons. They exercise their power and influence in human governments, Ephesians 6:12. They may enter and control human beings, Matthew chapter 12, verse 45. And of course, you say here, this last activity of entering and controlling people leads us to examine briefly demon possession in the Bible. Well, Doctor, with some of those activities listed here, do you see how exactly, let's say someone gets a Ouija board, and we know these demonic activities are associated directly through the occult, and of course the Ouija board falls in that category. What does it take for someone to be playing with the Ouija board? Can they get involved in demonic activities immediately, or does it take a long time? Does it take 2 weeks, a month, a year? How, I guess what I'm looking for is, what does it take for someone who gets a Ouija board to really get involved and enmeshed and entrapped, let's say, in demonic activity by playing with a Ouija board?
Well, the answer would relate to each individual. In some cases, I have seen or read where a person using it one time would get involved where they start speaking other voices and the like. They might have been prepared by something previous to this, but they're vulnerable immediately. Others, it would take a week, 2 weeks, a month, and they would experience these things that would obviously be demonic working. You can't say it's going to be immediate or it's going to take a long period of time. It depends on the individual. I've seen the immediate and I've seen the long-term involvement bring this kind of a manifestation. In other words, don't get involved because you might be the one that succumbs immediately. Don't get involved at all to begin with, but I'm just saying it can be extremely dangerous, just like drugs. That's exactly what Ed Warren says. A Ouija board is just as dangerous as drugs, not to be played with. And who knows what will happen. One use maybe is it, or maybe a period of time, nothing happens, and suddenly. And sometimes what happens, you have these manifestations that might start very benign, and they become worse and worse as time goes on. I'll just cite a book here, The Satan Trap, Danger of the Occult, by Martin Eban. He is not writing as a Christian, but he's writing as a parapsychologist, authored many books on the subject. And he mentions what we would term in our book progressive entrapment, where you start for kicks and you get information and then things like that, but then suddenly there might be a turn where the messages become vulgar and abusive and threatening, and sometimes the individual then is actually seized, possessed, taken over. And again, it can be very short period of time, or it can take a little bit longer, but you have to look at every case individually to answer that question.
Okay, what would you say to, let's say, a Christian family who has a Ouija board in their possession, or maybe they have a relative or something that they know has a Ouija board and they don't realize the danger? What would you counsel them to do?
I don't care where they get the information, but I think they should read something like my book or any source, I don't care what it is, to be informed as to what this is, so they know what they're dealing with. And then I would just tell them to renounce it and to get rid of it and not have anything to do with it.
I sort of like this reference in Acts chapter 19, where it starting in verse 18, it says, "And many that believed came and confessed and showed their deeds," verse 19, "many of them also which used curious arts brought their books together and burned them before all men, and they counted the price of them and found it 50,000 pieces of silver. So mightily grew the word of God and prevailed."
Yeah, that's a tremendous reference that covers this whole occult realm, and I've often quoted that because many times people see the light on what they should do, and here's the pattern: denounce it, destroy it, get rid of it. And in some cases, they're not going to get any deliverance from that until they do. I've seen cases where people have continued having problems. They found some occult device they'd used in the past that was present in their home, and they got rid of it, and the presence, the problems, the obsession, possession, whatever it was, stopped at that point.
Edmund Gruss, thank you very much for being on the program. We're out of time, and we hope to have you on again sometime.
Okay.
Check out our websites, BibleQuery.org. This site answers 7,700 Bible questions. HistoryCart.com. This site reveals early church history and doctrine, proving Roman Catholicism is not historically or doctrinally viable. MuslimHope.com. This site is a classic refutation of Islam, a counterfeit religion created by Muhammad. Free newsletters are also available.